We're here on the outer edge of Lithgow, but only a kilometre from Main Street. And we're on the northern side. We have 1,000 acres of conservation reserve here. Part of it's owned by myself and part by Australian Ecosystems Foundation. And we're back onto Wallamai National Park and the Nunes Plateau forestry area. Down here on the valley floor, we have Secret Creek Sanctuary and Secret Creek Cafe and Restaurant. Inside this sanctuary here, we have a number of endangered species from the Blue Mountains region. So we've got dingoes and emus and quolls and all sorts of things here.
I can't wait to meet some of them. We're standing in front of a massive set of green gates that say push. So shall we push and go and have a look?
Yeah, come on in.
Excellent.
Have you ever seen an eastern quoll in the wild? If you have, you're either in Tasmania or have a really good memory. It's been 50 years since the last confirmed sighting of an eastern quoll on the Australian mainland, long enough that the marsupial is now considered locally extinct outside of Tasmania. While this isn't a particularly happy anniversary for the quoll, there's still hope, largely thanks to the work of people like Trevor Evans. Hi, I'm Joel Werner and you're listening to Off Track, RN's show about nature, the environment and the outdoors. And today, Trevor's taking me on a tour of Secret Creek.
So this is a double airlock of gates to keep secure the fence line that we have here. We keep out foxes and cats because a lot of the species we have here are basically missing because of foxes and cats.
Off to our left, these are a couple of emus.
Yeah, they're reasonably friendly. They're on the other side of the fence, obviously, but these are two emus from the Sydney Basin area. And there's not a lot of emus left in the Sydney Basin. As you know, places like Emu Plains haven't got emus anymore. So there's a few left on, you know, ADI sites and things like that, but they're a smaller, more aggressive emu than the ones you get further west. Some people they like to take advantage of if they're a bit smaller in height. The person is a bit smaller in height than the emu. They like to stand over them. But there's a few tricks you can learn to put the emu in its place by just putting your hand and your arm up higher than them and making your hand the shape of an emu head.
Yeah, right.
And if you're taller than them after that, you're a bigger emu, so you're more dominant, so they'll leave you alone.
Good trick, yeah. This one here's got a magnificent blue streak on its on the side of its head.
They're typical male markings, yeah.
They're magnificent birds, they're great.
There's some brush-tailed rock wallabies here.
Yeah, okay. So where would they be found normally?
They're up and down the east coast in the ranges in huge numbers back in the 1800s, but they were shot out a lot. There's a few left at Jenolan Caves and a few out in Wallamai and then a few north up near Armidale and the Warramungles. You can hear them there jumping across the top of the water tanks.
How many wallabies would you have?
We've got about 120 wallabies, but we've got eight different types. So the rock wallabies, I've got brush-tailed rock wallabies I've got here, about 40. You can see that one there's got a baby hanging out of its pouch, quite small, just starting to fur up. The wallabies tend to like to hang around the restaurant here. I think they're probably the smartest, the brush-tailed rock wallabies of all the wallabies. They know exactly what's going on and when feed time is and all those sort of things. So they like basking in this afternoon sun as well.
So we're about to head into the sanctuary now, Trev?
Yeah, this is just through the gates that separate the restaurant and the sanctuary. The animals don't recognise them, but people do. The animals are both sides of the fence and jump all over the restaurant and all over the veranda, unfortunately. But come on in and into our foundation office.
Inside the office, we find endangered carnivore expert, Dr. Kelly Lee.
Good afternoon.
Hello. I'll give you an example of what we're up to today, which was we've got volunteers who come in and help feed the tiger quolls here, and while they're feeding them, they collect poo for me, which I then go and plant up in the bush up in Hassan's Walls Reserve, and we take our wildlife detection dog up there to evaluate how he tracks scats in different conditions, because there's a lot of use now of detection dogs to find low density and threatened wildlife. Things like tiger quolls are really hard to find now by traditional methods, so no one's really evaluated how they perform in different environments in Australian conditions. condition. So that's one of the projects we've got going on at the moment.
So explain to our listeners the idea of a detection dog. It's like if you want to find one of these endangered species, then you train a dog to sniff it out. Is that the basic idea?
Yeah, so it's based on the concept of sniffer dogs that are used in airports to sniff out drugs and explosives dogs and that sort of thing. And these are dogs now that are being used for invasive species quite a bit, for finding foxes and cats and rabbits and that sort of thing. But now that we've got so many threatened species and they're in really low numbers and hard to find, it's a really nice application. There's now a growing movement to use them for wildlife. So things like the tiger quoll have got big home ranges and they're in low densities naturally as carnivores. And because they're so threatened, they're disappearing and they're really hard to find. And dogs have got such incredibly accurate noses that they'll find things that we'll miss. So Badger is the detection dog, Australia's first quoll dog, and he's doing an awesome job tracking scats that are over a year old that are just tiny fragment-sized things that you can't even see until he sits on top of them and tells you he's there. So, yeah, he does a great job.
So does he just find the scat or does he actually locate the animal as well?
No, we've just trained him to find the scat because that's less invasive. Obviously, if dogs are tracking wildlife directly, you've got to be a bit careful about that. But from the scats, we can get DNA, and things like tiger quolls use a communal latrine site, so they'll all come and poo in the one spot to communicate with each other. It's kind of like Facebook for quolls. And so if he finds a latrine site, then we can sample all of those scats and get the DNA and work out how many animals are using it, what sex they are, how related they are, and do like a population survey just based on poo.
Now, you've got some quolls on site here as well. Can we have a look?
Yeah, absolutely. There's the tiger quolls up the back and then the eastern quolls are here, which I'm sure Trevor will tell you about. We've got an exciting project there for reintroducing them back into the wild.
Let's go and see the tiger quolls. And what sort of dog is Badger? Is Badger around?
Yeah, he's just out the front, actually. He's an Australian Shepherd, so really high-energy working dog. Slightly crazy, which helps a lot. Bounds through the bush without any problems.
He's one of our tiger quolls here.
Wow. They've got this amazing textured fur. It's white spots all over a brown body. They're great.
You'll notice the spots all go all the way down the tail. The spotted tail quoll or tiger quoll, same thing. A little bit different to the eastern quolls that we have here as well. There's another one a bit closer here on the rock.
So where would these traditionally have been found? What's their natural habitat?
Oh, all up and down the east coast of Australia. Because they're an adaptive carnivore, they'll hunt in all sorts of habitats, but they're disappearing now. It's unusual to see them in the wild. Here, they're still sighted around the Blue Mountains area. Down in Victoria, for example, they're incredibly hard to find now. There's not many around. They get hit by foxes and cats, as do a lot of Australian marsupials. So, yeah, they're getting rarer and more elusive, unfortunately.
With endangered species like the tiger quoll, how difficult is it to look after them? Are they easy animals or difficult animals to keep here in captivity?
They're fairly robust in captivity. They breed quite well and they've got really healthy appetites. It's quite amazing to see them feed, actually. They'll get chicken necks and things for dinner and they've got the second strongest jaw power or bite of any mammalian predator based on body weight. Tassie devil's number one and these guys are number two. And they'll just chomp through a chicken neck, bones and all, like it's, you know, a butter sandwich. They'll just one into the other and it's all gone. So, yeah, there's not much they can't get through.
Does keeping them in captivity domesticate them to a certain extent, or do you try to avoid that?
Well, these ones have been probably now 10 or 12 generations in captivity, and they're a part of a breeding population that are held on the mainland by a number of different small sanctuaries and zoos. So we swap them out amongst ourselves to make sure the genetics are strong. And the ones we keep here are mostly here for education. The eastern quoll is the one that we concentrate on, but a lot of people come here saying, oh, there's plenty of quolls around, we see them here and there, and so we like to show them this is the quoll that they have seen that's taken their chickens or, you know, been hanging around the house eating the dog biscuits and show them the difference between that and the eastern quoll, which we breed here. We only have 4 tiger quolls, but we have 30 eastern quolls.
Well, should we go and have a look at the eastern quoll?
Yeah, sure.
Excellent.
This is their enclosures. There's one there just hiding in the foliage.
Right.
That's a fully grown male.
Really?
Yeah, so you can see the difference in body weight and size from a tiger quoll.
I mean, it seemed from the glimpse I got at least maybe half as big as the tiger quoll.
Well, the tiger quolls can get to 7 or 8 kilos. These go to a kilo maximum.
Wow, really?
The females are only about 600 or 700 grams. So we'll go inside and I'll get one out of bed for you.
Okay, great.
We'll hold it up close and we can talk about it.
They have an attitude difference as well. The tiger quolls are notoriously sort of voracious. Like if you see them in the wild, they'll stand up to you. They don't take any rubbish, whereas these guys are much more timid and delicate.
So while we're moving in, tell me a little bit about the program that you're running with the Eastern Quolls here.
So it's a partnership program. So Trevor at Secret Creek here has been breeding this species for 10 years with a view to getting a good gene pool together in captivity on mainland Australia to reintroduce them into the wild. So as part of my role for the foundation, I'm helping to develop that reintroduction program, which is to try and establish a free-ranging population protected within a feral-proof area and monitor those animals to see how they hunt and feed and how successfully they breed and how they adapt to those habitats and make sure they have enough refuges, and then to use that information to introduce them beyond that fence back into the landscape, obviously with a concurrent fox and cat control program as well.
Well, I can't wait to meet one. Let's go and get introduced.
Gotta keep it locked.
Do they break curfew?
They're pretty wild. So in here we have 10 breeding cages. They're quite large. There's two extra large ones. They're about 26 square metres. Standard ones are 18 square metres. They're all about 2.4 metres high. Each cage will hold a pair of eastern quolls. The larger cages will hold three in, two males and a female. And so heading into breeding season, we've been now checking all their microchips, know who's who in our little zoo, and just putting our pairs together ready for probably around the 1st of May, I'll start breeding. So the cages are half inside and half outside. They have natural vegetation on the outside section where they've got climbing opportunities, hollow logs, grassed area, and an opportunity to catch insects and little lizards and things that might come through. And then the undercover area has a sand base, so it keeps dry, and their box with their straw and their bedding and everything is in under that area. So they've got a nice dry area to retreat to when we get rain and snow and all the other things we get here in Lithgow. But I'll just open the door for you. And I'll see if there's a couple of them in bed. Now we'll block the hole up. We have one little female here. You can see she's got spots, so if you're nice and quiet, I'll be able to pick her up. There we go. You can see she's quite furry and fluffy, very soft, have a feel.
Ah, she's beautiful.
Mm. You can see she's about 650 grams. She won't get any bigger. She's just getting ready to breed. She'll start putting a bit of this fatty collar on around her neck. She's got a nice fat belly. Very sharp little claws, which are now tearing into my skin because we're making a bit of noise. Usually I'm nice and quiet when I hold them. All these animals that we have here are from Tasmanian stock, Tasmanian genetics. Our genetic testing has just come back to show that our population here is as varied and robust as a wild population in Tasmania. So we're very happy with that. 10 years of work has finally paid off just through having that genetic testing done to show we are doing the right thing. Now, the other quoll that we have here is another eastern quoll, but they're black.
Right.
And 5% of the population in the wild is black, which is quite rare, and they're probably the rarest carnivores in Australia is a black eastern quoll. And I'll just take you through to show you. Maybe there's one in bed over here.
You're listening to Off Track on RN. Coming to you from the Secret Creek Sanctuary. I'm Joel Werner.
Now look in there. We have two fawn ones and two black ones.
Yeah.
I have a little black one there. And another black one. Here we go. So I got her by the tail. She was taking off, so I grabbed her. But there, I can sit her on the rock there. You can see she's just very quick back into the hollow log, out through the grass there. Here's another black female, and there goes a fawn male and a fawn female. So this is a little female that's probably a little bit lighter than the last one. She's only probably about 550 grams. But these black quolls are very, very rare. You see a little sharp teeth there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're mainly used for insects, but they are very good on rats and mice and grasshoppers and things like that. Very quick.
Are they their own species of animal?
Mm, yeah, they are. So they're a dasyurid. All the marsupial carnivores, like things from Anticynuses through to tiger quolls, Tasmanian devils, they're all related to each other, but they're distinct species.
They're all pouched carnivores. So they all give birth to little tiny babies about grain of rice size.
Yeah, wow.
30 in one go. But inside their pouch, they only have 6 nipples to attach to. So the strongest gets to attach to a nipple, and the others fall away and die and are usually eaten by the mother as a intake of more protein, basically.
So if there's 6 nipples, do the 6 strongest survive or usually less than that?
Well, we can raise 6 here quite often. In the wild, you'd probably find that that 6 would end up becoming 2 or 3 to go through to adulthood for breeding. When the mother carries them in the pouch, they actually get too big and she walks along on her toes and they drag along the ground. And then at that stage, they actually ride on mum's back. They go hunting with her. Teach them how to find grasshoppers and moths and all those insects. So it's a really important stage of their development is to have all those insects. They're all like full of peanut butter, lots of great protein. That's when a few of them get left behind or lost or taken by owls or whatever. Because they're quite small. They can be a tiger quoll, for example, or a spotted tail quoll will kill and eat an eastern quoll.
Yeah, right. Okay, so no love lost between quolls.
No.
Of the different
species, yeah.
But that's also why they're so vulnerable, because these guys live on the ground, and so foxes and cats can get them much more easily, whereas the tiger quolls can escape up trees. And I've actually found in some of the areas where there's really healthy numbers of tiger quolls, they've actually shifted their diet, so they're hunting more gliders and arboreal prey because it's safer up there for them.
Yeah, right.
The breeding program here looks to be quite successful. Yeah, has it been an easy road? Or tell me about the past 10 years, did you say?
Well, yeah, 10 years. Like the first 6 quolls I got for the sanctuary here for Secret Creek cost $1,000 each.
Wow.
And we bred from those and found 2-3 years later that the genetic population of the quolls I bought wasn't good enough. So we had to basically start again. When these eastern quolls die, they die at 3 years. So we didn't breed anymore with that first batch of quolls. We had to start then each year bringing new quolls in from Tasmania. And from there, we've established a really good, healthy, robust group.
We're doing a great job. I mean, there's a lot of quolls here and they all look healthy. But 10 years ago, how did you get into breeding quolls? What was the moment that you were sitting down and you thought, I'm going to buy a bunch of quolls?
Well, there is a bit of a story to it, because I did catch a quoll when I was a kid. I found it in someone else's rabbit trap and released it and took it home and nursed it back to health, but it still lost its leg, but it was a spotted tail quoll, a bigger one, and it went on to live, and I would see it every now and then, it obviously raiding chook houses around the neighbourhood where I come from. So later on in life, I was working for another group of people who were building wildlife sanctuaries, and it was called Earth Sanctuaries, headed up by Dr. John Wormsley, and I worked for him building sanctuaries, and he had a population of quolls. And when I seen they were eastern quolls, I was very impressed, and there was none in New South Wales. So at the time, I acquired quolls through Earth Sanctuaries, brought them to New South Wales, got all the permits in place, built all the facility, and started breeding, basically. The quolls I breed go on to other reserves like Featherdale and other small zoos for educational animals. Of course, quolls die in their 3rd year, eastern quolls. You got to breed every year to ensure the population is robust and stable.
Outside the quoll sanctuary, I'm faced with a somewhat more familiar scene.
These dogs look like my dog when I get home after work and they're ready for a walk.
I think we've been a bit cruel, actually. This is feed time. We're coming over without a bucket of food. So they're pretty excited to see us. They're not dogs, they're dingoes, which are quite different. They're all genetically pure. People say, why is the Kelpie in with the dingoes? And it's actually a black dingo.
So tell me about purebred dingoes. So I've read that they're more so a pack animal than your domesticated dog.
Yeah, I believe so. They're a family unit more so than a pack. They're usually led by an alpha male, an alpha female, and probably 2 or 3 years before young ones that have decided to stay with the pack. But as they become mature, they usually displace out of the pack. you won't have packs where you have two large males running together. They basically need to sort out who's the boss and who's going to be the leader of the pack. And when it comes down to it, the females usually put them in their place as well.
Compared to keeping a domesticated dog, how are dingoes to look after?
Well, they'll do everything a normal dog can do except come back. They can teach them to do anything. We walk them on a lead each day around the outside of the sanctuary to help with our biosecurity. They mark their territory around the outside of the fence, and that keeps foxes and cats from challenging our fence. The volunteers do that, and they accept most people if they're introduced through me, basically, as the alpha pack male. Once you're introduced to them and you're friendly and we're friendly, they're fine. But one in probably 100 people, I just don't take to. They just don't like them. They don't smell right. They will not attack them, but they'll move away and hide in a corner and won't have anything to do with them.
Cat people.
I'd say so, yeah. But yeah, but they like cats. They just can't eat a whole one. So we have 10 dingoes here. We have the standard tan-coloured dingoes. We have the black dingo here, which is a North Queensland rainforest dingo. And we also have some white, or they call them apricot, alpine dingoes as well, which are quite rare. Everyone like to have a dingo, but they don't realise they're a little bit more high maintenance than a normal dog. They like to be with you all the time. If you go somewhere, they'll pine and whinge and cry for you till you come back, or break out of where they are to go find you. So you need to be able to spend 24/7 with your dingo. Even in the house, they'll follow you. They'll sleep on the end of the bed. You know, they'll be beside you on the lounge, and they'll be on the back of the ute if you drive somewhere. So they're just high maintenance and very clingy, unless you keep them in pairs, which makes it a bit easier. They're a beautiful dog, but they're not as easy to look after as a lot of people would like to think, like a normal dog.
And how does Badger get on with the dingoes? Is there a good relationship between dogs and dingoes?
Well, they don't meet up at all. The dingoes are inside the sanctuary in their own enclosures. Badger's outside, and Badger works and does his work separately.
Yeah.
And
right.
Kelly, they howl to each other through the fence regularly. Badger's now learnt to howl like a dingo, but he does a fairly shameful impersonation, so you'll hear a sort of a baritone as he tries to sing along with them, but that's about the limit for their contact.
So they're aware of each other, they just never come into contact. Yeah, right.
Yeah, they know they're there. Yeah.
Should we go and meet Badger?
Yeah, yeah, come on.
Badge. He'll be very delighted to see you.
We're up here with Badger. He's gone out tracking this morning. Can you tell us what he did this morning and just in general how you train a dog to track scat?
Well, I've been very lucky. I've had advice from a professional trainer up in Queensland, Martin Dominic from Canine Centre, and he's given me advice on how to build that relationship. And it's all about the dog getting the message in its head that to get its reward, whatever that is if it's toy or a food, that it has to first go and find something. So the way I started off with Badger was to just have a piece of cheese. Most animals will fall for a piece of cheese, and he's no exception. I had a piece of cheese in my hand, and he could see it and smell it, but it was blocked off, so he couldn't get it. And then I had a jar of qual poo in my other hand, and he worked out for himself that to get that piece of cheese, he had to stick his nose in the jar and smell it. And once he had that association, it's a matter of increasing the distance, so I could then go and hide the jar further away and just build in a word association like search. So he'd then go and search and find it, and he'd get his treat. And then I taught him to sit and then to bark when he found the odour, which in this case is tiger claw scat. Yeah, so it's a slow process, and then he tries to cheat and I have to outsmart him, and it's kind of ongoing, but it's gradually building that distance and that work ethic. So he knows now he doesn't even have to see the treat or the reward. I just put on his collar, which he knows is an association for him to work, and I grab his head and look in his eyes and say, ready to work, go search, and he'll just take off. And he'll just keep going now until he finds a scat, and then he'll sit and bark and call me in. So he doesn't need to be in visual contact anymore. He can go in the thick heathland or the forest. We're doing some heavy undergrowth stuff at the moment, and he can go off 100 metres away from me. And if he finds something, I know he'll sit and bark and wait for me and call me in, so I can lose sight of him and he'll still be working.
That's fantastic. So, and then you go in and he's sitting next to a scat, which you collect and then can analyse for your research.
Yeah, I can get DNA out of it, or in some cases it's just worth knowing presence, absence, to know that it's tiger qual habitat and are they still there as well. And I'm thinking he could also be useful testing him on non-target odours, and he's never indicated on anything else, but I'm testing him on fox and cat and wallaby poos and all that just to make sure. But it's quite expensive to send samples off for analysis of DNA. It's quite a common survey method, but he might have a use in people just sending samples in and they want to check if it's really a qual scat or something else, and he'll only sit and bark if it is. So he's got a range of uses.
He's just come over for a pat as well.
Yes, yes. Likes a bit of affection. Yeah, it's like, you betcha, hello.
She's smart enough to know it's all there.
Yeah. He uses the cute factor to his advantage as well.
Oh, and it's working. It's working.
Badger, Australia's first quoll detection dog. You also heard from Dr. Kelly Lee, Executive Officer of the Australian Ecosystems Foundation, and Trevor Evans, who owns and runs Secret Creek Sanctuary. To find out more about the foundation or the sanctuary, head to the Off-Track website. Just go to abc.net.au/radionational and search for Off-Track. At the website, you'll find links to further information, as well as an extended interview with Dr. Kelly Lee, in which she explains how 10 years spent working with large carnivores in Africa informs her work with the quolls in Lithgow. Subscribe to the Off Track podcast via your iTunes library, or come say hi on Twitter. I'm at Joel Werner. But that's all there is for this week. Until next time, bye for now.